Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Originally founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched in the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice, comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community. This is Season 10 of the White Book Podcast. Know the men who follow you, and let them know you. Don't ask your men to die for a stranger. There we go. Sage advice from Eddard.
Seems reasonable. But is that from a cat chapter, or is that from a John chapter?
Ooh, that is a great question. I don't know. Normally, I'm pulling it off of A Search of Ice and Fire so I can see the chapter references. This time, I pulled it off of a card, so I actually don't know.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
We'll need a listener to chime in and tell us. I mean, they won't, but we need them to.
In an ideal world.
In an ideal world. Man, the listeners, summertime, COVID, the end of the official game, whatever the combination is, man, they didn't even catch that I never posted the link to, at this point, the episode that was 2 weeks ago. I posted the link. The episode was like up in feeds and podcast search engines and the like, but I never bothered to post it in the Facebook group on accident. Nobody even caught it.
Well, you know, it's easy to miss that stuff, though.
Gone are the days when somebody like Aaron would hound me if I was, like, you know, 4 hours late posting an episode. Que sera, sera.
Yeah.
Ah, well, while we wistfully look back on the days that were, how about we continue our wistful look back at Thrones card releases?
Yeah, seems good. So I think that brings us on to the Stark Box is where we are, right?
Yes, sir.
The first deluxe box.
Wolves of Winter?
Wolves of the North.
Wolves of the North. There we go. I just wanted the alliteration so bad, and I didn't get it.
I sometimes confuse this with Lords of the North, which I think was the first edition one.
Oh.
Right?
Maybe. Or Winter? I've got them on a shelf behind me, but I realize now there's another box sitting in front of them, so I can't just turn around and read them easily from my seat at the desk.
You kept the boxes?
Yeah, the kind of like rainbow effect looks nice stacked up on the very top of my game shelf, like above all the ones that I actually get out and use. So I've got all the like a first ed core set and then all the expansions and then a second ed core set and all the expansions.
Yeah, when I first bought into first edition, I kept them all in their original chapter packs, like in boxes and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then before my first Gen Con, because we hadn't fully decided on one what decks we were bringing and people needed to build stuff, I put them in boxes. Like, I actually unpacked them in boxes.
Traditional card boxes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, in fact, my second edition collection is currently in binders, but I'll be moving it into boxes for moving and perma storage soon, so... It's much easier to store those boxes than it is these binders.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So, anyway, Wolves of the North. So there were three themes that Nate laid out that they were trying to develop here. Direwolves, House Tully, and Winter. Plus the concept of that there are two cards from one character and one non-character from each non-Stark faction. And they're all non-loyal. And they're designed to play with the Stark faction or play against the Stark faction. So where do you want to start, Will? Do you want to start at the big picture of deluxe boxes in second edition? Do you want to look about the themes? Do you want to talk about the non-Stark cards?
Yeah, let's start with the big picture of deluxe boxes, since this is our first one here. And especially because the first thought that occurs to me is the relevance of starting with the Starks in particular, which I think has obviously some Nedley connections, right? Aside from the prologue chapter, the Starks are the first perspective we get. They are far and away the favorite faction or family in the fan base for a very long time. Though, you know, I would be curious by the end of the HBO show to see if that had shifted. I'm sure Targ was giving them a run for their money, but I'm not dead certain if the Starks have held out in fandom.
I think they now have, considering that Arya and Sansa and Jon were popular characters up to the end of the show.
Yeah.
Like they were, you know, I think that like the big three, Targ, Lannister, Stark are probably still the most popular houses. And I'd say Stark, it's hard to dislodge Stark just simply because there's so many of them, you know?
Yeah. We get what, double them as probably the next closest house, the Lannisters.
Yeah. And they're just so central to so much of the action of the show, particularly, you know, Jon and towards the end of the show, Sansa. Like a lot is going on with both of them that I imagine their popularity kind of never really waned.
Yeah. So, it makes perfect sense then to start with Stark as the first box. So that was my most top level thought.
Yeah, I think there's, I really don't understand the release box order beyond the first two of Stark and Lannister. Mm-hmm. Because why was Targ last? I still don't understand that, like, to this day.
Yeah, I don't know. Because we went to Night's Watch.
Which are a popular faction.
Thanks
to Jon.
Right. That's my best guess, is that they wanted to capitalize on Jon's popularity from the show. But then you go Targ and then Greyjoy. Whoops, sorry, I'm trying to
Tyrell stuff. Martell, Tyrell, Greyjoy, Martell. Baratheon, Targaryen.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. That's
Some of them feel like it's market research, right? Like, you know, if you think about it, four of the five most popular factions are, you know, represented in the first five boxes, but definitely Targaryen is more popular than Martell. I know that I'm sure there's Martell loyalists who are going to flip out about that idea, but
sure.
I think it's kind of inarguable that Dany is one of the like most iconic characters of the series. And the fact that it was the last box, I guess if something's going to be last, you make it one of the more popular ones, because Lannister was the last first edition box, right?
No, I think it was Targ again.
Targ again?
Yeah.
Did they?
Wasn't it?
I don't know. I started playing after all the boxes were out. So
yeah, I'm trying to think if there is actually a easy place for me to check that release order now. The Game of Thrones listing on Card Game DB. Maybe. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Assuming this order is right. The first dead boxes went Greyjoy, Martell, and that definitely sounds right. Then Stark, then Baratheon, then Targ, then Lannister was indeed last.
Okay. Cause it makes sense, right? Cause Martell and Greyjoy were not fully fleshed out in the core set, right? So
yeah in the first dead. So those were definitely the first two. That is extremely familiar.
This seems about right from what I remember people talking about, but
yeah but we didn't have to deal with that in second ed.
No, thank goodness. Very smart decision to support all eight factions from the beginning. But yeah. Anyway, besides release order, I think that on a meta level, the boxes, I feel like the boxes started off from a place where they were designed to be evergreen products that were at a power level somewhere around the core set. And I think the Stark box and the Lannister box kind of succeed at that.
Mm-hmm.
But the later boxes don't. Starting with the Night's Watch box, which I think is a pretty significant power level increase from the first two, but still somewhere within the realm of the first two boxes. And then once you get to the Tyrell box.
All gloves are off.
All gloves,
so to speak.
The Martell box. It's all down. From there.
Now the question is that due to changing designers and Danny having a different mentality? Is that because FFG is a more generic whole changed their vision of what boxes are supposed to do? Or does the conspiracy theorist in me say, hey, at that point they already realized they were not going to bother with rotation?
I think it's none of the above. I think okay. The boxes still had to influx new cards to affect the existing metagame. So they were always designed not in a... Once there were enough cards at a higher power level, you know, starting around when the third cycle really kicks off into the fourth cycle, you know, you start building boxes not as in conversation on a design level with the core set, but in a conversation with where the game is right now. And that creates all kinds of issues. And you start trying to make cards that respond to existing metagame problems, which you would generally do in a chapter pack rather than creating like evergreen tools for a faction's core identity.
Yeah.
And you get into situations where there's factions like Tyrell, which, you know, going to that box, Tyrell was definitely one of the weaker factions, particularly like a mono Tyrell deck, particularly one that's not a rush mono Tyrell deck. And you start injecting power into it to bring it to the level of where other cards are. So I think the box design philosophy is a victim of the slow release of chapter packs, the fact that the card pool at LCGs is pretty small in general, and the fact that rotation is very slow.
If at all.
But never, I mean.
There's still only one LCG in Fantasy Flight's history that has made it to rotation.
Isn't L5R's got to be approaching it relatively soon, right?
Hasn't made it yet.
So
the non-cynical part of me just factually says it has not made it there yet. The cynical part of me says, don't expect it to make it past it.
Fair.
Thinking though about those type of like top level design issues with the boxes, I think it might be worth taking a look at the way the deluxe boxes, try to still, let's say, justify their sales to a broader perspective of the community than only Stark fans, right? By including a couple cards for every other faction, cards that are all non-loyal. At the base level, I can see that makes sense, right? Especially if your projected entry path into the game is to buy a core set and then buy a house box of your favorite faction.
Definitely what I did when I started.
Right, right. And so then by making these cards non-loyal, you minimize the number of dead, so to speak, cards that folks have off the bat. And it, you know, if done well with the synergistic stuff, then you can maybe lay out some guideposts on deck construction, right? Like maybe you want to build the crossover knight deck that uses some Tyrell stuff and some Stark stuff, or you know, whatever the combination might be, it can give you that. But I think you run into a couple weird issues, one quickly and one later. The quick one is when you then have some of these cards designed as off faction like counters in that box, because now you've muddled what your goal is. Now you're saying, well, yeah, my intro path for people is to buy a core set in one of these. But then instead of all focusing on giving them cool stuff to build, well, now I'm also giving them counter pieces, which, wait a minute, if they just excitedly bought the Stark box, well, they probably don't want to blow their time building a Martell deck to counter the Stark deck or whatever. So it's just kind of a muddling of that clear path. I would have liked to have seen the answer cards be planned at the time like that the box was designed, and then have them release in the cycle after that box.
Right. I guess the problem would run into where, say, there's some very powerful Stark theme. Let's say, like, Direwolves is very powerful. It's not, but... And you print, like, two anti-Direwolf cards. You don't want those ever rotating, right? If you think that theme is super powerful and you want players to always have access to it. Right, to the answers.
But I guess if you are already planning on a product to be evergreen, then you should probably be careful with that power level as well, or maybe include, you know, counter themes as a more generic rather than silver bullet style. I don't know. It just feels kind of off. And then speaking of that design and how you handle that, then you get into issues later on, like you were saying, about boxes become much more reactionary to the card pool at that time, the broader pool, the meta movements at stake at that point in time. And then you wind up with very weird things, like, say, the Lannister... Man, I always want to say the wrong location. It's not the red. It is the Red Keep. Okay. Yeah. I always want to screw up which one it is. That is printed as non-loyal because of the constraint of it's in a box. All of the non-like main house cards are non-loyal, but all of the other like indicators in that design, and even in the meta response to that it was kind of created for, all of those point toward it being loyal. And so you set yourself up for some very strange situations like that as time goes on.
Yeah, I actually think the biggest flaw in the overall philosophy to boxes that's laid out here is that all non-Stark cards are non-loyal. I think that if they had the flexibility to make a few of them loyal based on design and balance needs, I think that it would have led to better boxes.
Yeah.
Because I think it, I mean, this is me spilling at least a little bit of tea from playtesting. I think there were times when cards got nerfed too much because they were loyal or couldn't be loyal. And I think in a box, and I think that later, you know, like Red Keep is entirely a problem in that box because there's going to be no future product. And so that's probably why it's there. But also there's the reverse problem, which is there's push cards that, you know, need to get loyal slapped onto them, but they can't because of, you know, the constraint of the box's meta design. And I think it was definitely a flaw, and one that's going to, we'll come back to when we get to those specific boxes.
Yeah.
Do we want to go theme by theme?
I think that seems reasonable, the way that Nate presented them in the article here then.
So Tully's first?
Yeah.
So I have a soft spot for the Tully cards. The Stark box, the only successful deck that I ever built entirely by myself in second edition, I built shortly after the Stark box came out, and it was a Stark combo cat build. You know, running the River Realm, running River Realm Minstrel and Big Cat, and I made the top 8 of the first Dance of Dragons with it before losing horribly to Dark Naj in the cut. And I have a soft spot. And of course, these cards have proven over time to be extremely powerful. And the Stark Sacrifice theme, which I think was actually kind of a failure for a long time, but which is actually pretty good. Because one of the things that is good about the Stark theme is if rotation did exist, you can rotate out the overpowered sacrifice cards like Skagos and Wyman and still have, you know, a skeleton of that theme that always exists in the card pool. And you can rotate out one set of support cards and rotate a different one that do sacrifice a different way. So while the sacrifice theme is not particularly strong out of this box, I think the skeleton it builds is pretty good. And I think it's probably the most successful theme in the box.
Oh, yeah. I think without a doubt the most successful. So the sacrifice theme, which you kind of segued into there, I mean, get some key pieces here, but it was not expressly one of the themes that they wanted to hit on, or at least not one of the new ones they wanted to hit on, that is, because it was definitely present in Stark out of the core set. But I think this is one of the best examples of a way for one of these deluxe boxes to expand on themes that were kind of hinted at in the core set, and give them more depth, without, or at least maybe a linchpin in Caitlin's sense, but without pushing them over the top. This was kind of where something like Sacrifice matured, but didn't become overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. You know, I kind of conflated the Tullys and Sacrifice there, because, of course, over time, the Tully theme kind of just became about combo and cat.
They became that, but it, spelled out here, it's just Rush is,
yeah,
basically all they say the point is, right?
Yeah, which I think is which is kind of weird, right? Because Cat, the 7-cost Cat, you know, who she's 7-cost, 5-strength, intrigue, power, House Tully, loyal lady, the 7, Catelyn Stark gets +1 strength for each power she has. After a Stark character you control is sacrificed or killed, Catelyn gains 1 power limit twice per round. This is kind of like the signature card of the box, and she's the most important Tully character in the box, and she only kind of a little bit has to do with the Power Rush theme, which I think is a weird design decision. Not saying, like, I love this card. I think it's the best design of the Mace effect. I mean, the fact that Mace became famous for this effect before Catelyn tells you initially how powerful she was. I think this is like the fairest version of this effect. I think she's a really well-designed card, but you know, the fact that she kind of doesn't super synergize with the rush aspects, obviously she's good with River Run Minstrel, but she doesn't like specifically help you. You know, rush decks aren't about eating up their own board, right? Usually. And so she's just a weird card to be the highlight of the Tullys from a rush perspective.
Right. It's, yeah. I mean, because she, from a Nedley sense, I guess, has really pretty well given herself over to the Stark identity. So it's weird. But also the Tullys from a flavor perspective, I mean, folks really into the lore stuff, of course, will always point out that the Tullys are a distinct great house. So it kind of does make sense to push them as a cohesive faction of some kind, even if it is a sub-faction to the Starks, to have that representation. I mean, and they have a lot of fan favorite characters, even some of the more bit players like the Blackfish, for instance. So, yeah, I mean, I can see how they got. Go ahead.
Then Blackfish is a traditional rush card.
Right. Definitely. Definitely. And looking at the rest of the box, I mean, honestly, they didn't get a lot in the traditional rush kind of perspective. The Blackfish is obviously the Minstrel that you mentioned earlier. He is definitely a rush card, but not quite in that traditional vein. In fact, if I were to throw any card out as a low point here, I might give it to the Minstrel, because people really despise losing a game in the marshalling phase.
I love Minstrel. It's one of my favorite cards.
Oh yeah, people love winning the game in the marshalling phase. It's just losing it that stings. But I mean, past that, there really isn't much.
Right. I mean, the best rush card in the pack is Eddard.
Yeah, who is definitely
not a Tully.
Not Tully.
So.
And if anything, the where is he? The Septon, he's anti rush, right? If you're trying to get power as fast as you can, there's not many situations where you want to give that power away to get a little bit of money.
Yeah, because I guess there's like this attempt to kind of play around with this, like, using power as an alternative resource theme in the Tullys as well. That doesn't entirely work. Like with the House Tully Septon, Catelyn giving power, Blackfish not kneeling, you know, it's, which is like interesting, but it never coheres in the box, and it never super coheres in the broader card pool other way, except around the idea of like combo cat.
Yeah. Yeah. It all just becomes sacrifice fuel for her, like you were talking earlier.
So, but I definitely appreciate the Tully / sacrifice theme. I think it's the best theme in the pack. It kind of like, it does, while it doesn't cohere to particularly strong set of cards, it does, there are clear signposts, and it does, I think, overall have a positive effect on the game and on the card pool.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always a sucker for tribal stuff, so even if the Tullys are not really as organized around a particular interlocking theme, I'm excited to have it there.
So the next one is the puppies. Direwolves. What do you think of direwolves in this box? How successful?
That it definitely does not even come together as much as the Tollies. I mean, the direwolves are already a kind of hamstrung by all of the characters only having military icons.
Multiple icons.
Yeah, that's a great question. And like from a really like thematic Nedley sense, I admit it's very hard to justify anything other than a military icon for the dire wolves and even for the dragons. But so they're already hamstrung on that front, and then they don't get much here that cares about it. I mean, you get the Wolves of the North, which does definitely key off of other dire wolf cards if you want to hit that tribal theme.
Definitely the best signal of the theme. And
yeah, but it's even kind of a weird, right? Gosh, trying to put these thoughts in the right order, because we're already in this icon hampering issue, right? They effectively only have one icon available to them, the direwolves, that is. So this card has stealth, which is potentially good because if you're going in hard on one icon, if your opponent has a way to disrupt that, maybe you want some stealth to get around stuff and whatever. Okay, I can sort of see that, and it makes some Nedley sense on the wolf pack. But then you're giving this minus X strength to that character, which then means like you're not incentivized to do it on the character you've already stealthed, because their strength is already not going to count in this challenge. So you're incentivized to do it on some other character, which means now you're wasting the stealth because you're stealthing a character that has, say, a power icon that maybe you're going to make a challenge with a different character. And so it doesn't help with this challenge at all, but you've gone in hard on military to have the dire wolves. And I don't know. It's emblematic of how they're kind of just hamstrung here until we get a very different Bran Stark much later. As neat as it is, it's so narrow that it can't accomplish much.
Yeah, I mean, Sam Bratz did show that the direwolves have a little bit more power than you would think, but some of that success was post that brand, but some of it was pre that brand, right? If I remember right. Because Wolves of the North is very powerful, or Time for Wolves, not Wolves of the North, excuse me. A Time for Wolves is very powerful, which I think is one of the better direwolf cards in here. Wolves of the North is an obnoxious card, mostly because of its combo with Grey Wind. I've never particularly enjoyed that combo. I've had it done to me and at various different levels in the game. I don't know what it is where I'm always being paired against Dark players who want to do the Wolves of the North Grey Wind player combo. But I think that the biggest issue is, I agree with you, is I do think if there had been something like the Bran effect in this box, you know, it could have been, you know, like a direwolf only version of what's the song that gives all three icons until end of turn. Off to Gold Town. Right? Off to Gold Town, isn't that the song that gives everybody all three icons?
Be Gold Town Survey says yes.
Yeah. So if there had been like an event version of that, that was like, you know, says like give a dire wolf an icon of your choice or all three icons until end of turn or something, that would have, I think, just made the dire wolves stronger. You know, we can argue here, and I would argue that some of the dire wolves could get power icons on a thematic level as symbol of Stark power and prestige. you know, particularly Grey Wind. There could definitely be a Grey Wind with a power icon. But that's, I think, going a little too much into the weeds. I just think that the fact that it's just the military icon that they have really does limit their possibilities out of the box. So I would definitely say that this is the second worst of those themes. And that's mostly only because the winter theme is so awful that I forgot that it would actually existed as a theme.
Well, it's bad, not just in this box, but pretty much across all of second edition.
Although that's not true, because winter's been making some roads in the current meta. Will, I don't know how closely you've been following things, but
I have not been following recent developments as much as I might have.
What was it called? It's called Crows, right?
Well, while you get that pulled up, I will just throw out there that for at least a very long chunk of second ed, Winterfell is effectively the only winter card that has mattered.
Yes, absolutely true. A Stark Fealty player playing a wintery build came in second at Feast for Crows 2, and then someone playing Stark Kings of Winter came in ninth. Just missed the top.
Kings of Winter.
On tiebreakers. So, and they both were playing winterish builds, using Wolves of the North, actually. So as
hey, all right.
So yeah, I mean, Winterfell is the strongest card in the pack. It's been the most influential card of the pack as well, I think. In its overall pack, I don't think it has really left non-Rush Stark decks, and there were Rush Stark decks that play Winterfell down to today. Maybe not all three, but definitely it's still there. It's been a powerful force in the metagame since its release. It's just all around the best card in the pack. I mean, yeah, the best card in the pack. But it just does such a poor job of pushing the winter theme, which I think less has to do with the reward that Winterfell gives you, because I think actually the reward Winterfell gives you for running winter plots is really strong. It's the fact that the winter plots are notoriously just garbage.
Yeah.
Like the one in this pack, which is... there's actually two. Ranger's Cache...
And Snowed Under?
It's a bunch, actually. Winter's Cache,
but yeah.
Long Winter, Snowed Under. All three are pretty bad. Ranger's Cache, I so wanted to be good. I so wanted this card to be good, but it has never proven to be good. Long Winter's okay. It's come in and out of the meta. Snowed Under is a weird melee card.
That's what I was going to say. Is it has its melee plays, for sure.
But the fact that these are the winter plots, and you know, the only other there was only one winter plot, I believe, in the core set.
One that I recall offhand, at least the two claim. But was there anything else?
Because like March doesn't have it, right? I don't think there was anything else.
March is just an edict. So yeah, I think Winds of Winter is the only winter plot we have in the core set.
Yep, and so the fact that there's only maybe like two playable winter plots for like the first year, which was First Snow of Winter and Long Winter. And then you know, as you start seeing, as we'll get to later, once we get to the second cycle in a couple of weeks, summer plots just become really strong. So. It just becomes really just not attractive to run winter. I think maybe the success of some winter decks recently have shown that winter's finally been pushed enough to be playable, but it just, again, Winterfell is such a busted card, but Stark winter decks just were never quite there, even though this card, Winterfell, which I'll just read one more time, at 4 cost, the Winterfell, each Stark character control gets +1 strength reaction after a challenge is initiated. Neil Winterfell, then each player with a non-winter plot card revealed cannot trigger card abilities until the end of the challenge. This card is just so good, but the winter theme is so bad. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what else there is to say about the winter theme such as it is. I mean, that as far as a theme goes, it's all just kind of a random mishmash of effects that just are only active in some relation to winter plots. And some are if the plots are revealed as hard as winter. I honestly, if you had asked me 30 seconds ago, I would have sworn up and down that it only worked if there was a winter plot card revealed. But no, it's only play only if there's a winter plot card in your used pile, which actually I'm not even sure now if that's used on virtually any of the others.
Kind of a holdover from first edition.
Yeah. So there's just calling it a theme almost seems too generous to me. They're just disparate effects that need this one thing to turn on. And because they are so all over the place, it is definitely the worst theme in the box.
Yep. Yeah. And super sad. But Winterfell was, again, it's been the police person of the meta for four years.
Yeah. As frustrating as it can be to play against sometimes, I would probably call it the all-star of this whole box, as far as, you know, best card, longest steady play, you know, solid pressure valve sort of place in the metagame, just across the board. I would say it has made the best home for itself.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
with that pause, I definitely thought you were coming back with Caitlin instead.
No. I think objectively it's the best card. It's the only one here that's never fallen out, really, of the meta. Yeah. And, you know, it just constantly the Stark Fun Police deck, which started existing basically with this box, has never really left. Even when Stark was on the downswing, it still could constantly, when it was underestimated, prove that it still had some powerful cards. Actually, the more surprising thing about this box is just that some of these cards are still playable and, you know, still are forced in the meta. We have Catelyn, Eddard, Sansa, Winterfell. Let me see. And then that's the Stark cards that jump off to me. Rickon. Oh, I missed Ricky. Almost missed Ricky.
Yeah. Granted, he did not see much play until pretty late in the second ed life cycle.
Yeah, once the search effect started to get pretty powerful. But besides Sam started playing him. And then some of these like non-Stark cards, like Evenhanded Justice, his Viper Eyes, Shadow Tower, Ago, House Florent Knight, Rain, Weapons at the Door, Fallen from Favor. These all cards that you see in the game to present. Like if someone flips this card in setup or on their first turn plot, you're like, okay, these are reasonable cards. Which is surprising when you think about that this box was designed with, you know, a much lower power level than later boxes.
Yeah. Well, one thing about the design, when you're running through all these cards, something that struck me, and this may have something to do with design aesthetic changing as the years go by, shall we say. Mm-hmm. Right, because when second ed was launched, it seemed that Melee was going to be pushed as well, right? Of course, you've got titles in the core set and all that. And honestly, looking at this, there's a lot of reasonable melee staples out of this box as well. Caitlin and Eddard both. Definitely see Riverrun Minstrels pop up.
Oh yeah.
What else here? I mean, I have definitely seen Winterfells in melee as well. Let's see, Even-Handed Justice. Let's see what else that has seen. Maybe that's a. About the and Snowed Under. I knew there was something else further down in the list. So as far as like melee goes, that's probably some of the biggest density of heavily played melee cards right here in this box.
Yeah. It's a remarkably powerful box, even though again it was self-consciously designed to not be so. So that's kind of well, it's kind of interesting when you think about the later boxes, which are much less self-consciously designed that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, overall, I think the Stark box, I think, is a pretty good success. I think it does set some troubling precedents that I think we talked about at the beginning of the podcast. But overall, thinking about it now, I think I like the Stark box.
I think I do as well. I think this is probably as close to my ideal of a like power level for this type of box as any of them come. It doesn't push too hard in any direction. It still has a lot of staples, like you said, that see strong but not like overwhelming play, pushes into a couple new areas while still expanding on things introduced in the core. I think this is probably going to be as close to the ideal box as I could find.
Yeah, I think it is important to remember, though, that this box did have a little bit of a negative impact on the meta because it did influx a bunch of good to decent Stark cards into the card pool at a time when the other factions weren't as developed. And yeah. Stark kind of became, you know, Stark wasn't the worst faction out of the core set, but it definitely wasn't in the top four.
And
it's kind of like it floated on the back of this box being. I think that the Lannister and the Stark box kind of, they're really interesting to think about side by side, because the Stark box kind of like was a medium power level box introduced towards one of the weaker factions, and then a medium power level box, that was for one of the stronger factions, Lannister, which when we talk about that, we can kind of like bring these two boxes in the conversation with each other, because I think they're interesting when you think about them that way. Because the Lannister box did not have the effect that the Stark box had on
that is true.
And some of the problems with Lannister actually has to do with the fact that Lannister was too powerful when it was released, much too powerful. And that kind of created that confined design space for what's supposed to be an evergreen product. And we can talk more about that then, though.
One thought that popped up just now that we maybe should have tackled at the beginning in the, broad strokes sort of issue about the box release. As you said, the way the meta was skewed heavily to Stark with this type of release, that I do kind of think that dropping multiple boxes as close together as possible probably would have been better for virtually everything, not only in not skewing the meta as much, but also keeping a consistent power level between the boxes, right? If like, sure, dropping all eight of them in the first year probably would not have been feasible at all, but maybe four in, you know, 1 year and then the other four the next year, or an idea that I had vaguely kicked around, geez, maybe way back in first edition. It's been a long time. I remember pushing for something at the time I was calling like dual boxes, which you can play on the fact that people usually use the wrong dual when they're speaking on the internet. Whichever one they need, they frequently say the other one. And you could do this either way, dual meaning two, or dual as a battle between two, and pair up the houses so that you had a couple dropping at once. At least that I think would have balanced the meta a little bit more. And you could do fun, you know, classic pairings too. Like start with, you know, the Starks versus the Lannisters or something like that. The Baratheons versus the Targaryens. And you can still pull in, you know, the fandom based on that kind of stuff. So,
yeah. I mean, the question about whether or not the box philosophy is one of the better, is like a good one, is an interesting one. I guess I'm skeptical, having played first edition, the Star Wars LCG, and now second edition. I think faction boxes are a mistake. Yeah, basically. It'd be probably just be better to just be releasing chapter packs. Or I guess now what do they do? They're like, there's something, what did L5R come up with? That technically the things I do for love is an example of, like a premium pack that's like between a box and a, you know, and
that sounds about right, because I think that's actually what they have been doing for their, instead of a house box, they've had clan specific packs of that size.
Yeah that might be better. I still think just basically equally supporting each faction and just having more releases is probably, I think, better, just because the way in which, even if you're like doing a Stark versus Targ box, or you know, a Bear versus Targ box, right, that equally supports Bear and Targ, it doesn't support the other factions, right? So there's always going to be these weird, like,
sure,
imbalances. Like, I get it as like a sellable thing to a game store. You know, you game store goes, you know, You came in, you bought the core set for last week. You really loved it. The first question you ask is, what's your favorite faction? And you have a sale right there, right?
Right. It's that entry path, or at least it started that way.
But it just, I think, creates problems for it as a game. And, you know, as you note, like releasing all of them, all eight at once, is either an impossible expense for both FFG designers and the players. Like, could you imagine buying a core set and then, you know, like 3 months later they release eight deluxe boxes? That's like, you know.
Well, I can remember the L5R outcry at the price of having to buy all six chapter packs of their first cycle all at once, basically. I mean, they weren't quite, it was what, one a week or something like that, but eight boxes would be so much worse.
Yes, I think I have the first cycle of L5R. Look in this file. I think I do. Yeah, dynasty packs, that's what they call them.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's not here nor there. Wow, there's actual dust on my L5R cards. Yeah, but I think that being for what they are, I think that this box does about as good of a job as you could ask, and I think was a pretty good starting point. We'll see where they go from there, though.
Indeed. I'm sure we will talk about them. All right. I think that probably covers us for this box, and we will catch you next time, listeners.